This is KLOILP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM, Lopez Community Radio on this Monday morning at 11 o'clock with This Strange and Wonderful World and Richard Fagan. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Carol.
And you're going to hear in the background kind of a white noise. It's very warm in this trailer, so we're keeping the air conditioning on. This is a pre-recorded program, and where are we going to go today?
Well, we're going to go to Polynesia and the Pacific in general to talk about Polynesian navigation, and the background noise shouldn't bother us too much. Think of it as the wind in the sails, okay?
Great. Thanks for that help.
Yeah. The story really begins when Ferdinand Magellan crosses the Pacific, the first voyage around the world and the first voyage by Europeans across the Pacific Ocean. And his chronicler, a man by the name of Pigafetta, wrote in the report on this voyage about the Pacific, a sea so vast that the human mind can scarcely grasp it. It took them months and months and months to get across, finally ending in the Philippines where Magellan was killed. And to give people an idea of this, when I gave lectures about the Second World War, and particularly the war in the Pacific, I would superimpose a map of the United States over a map of the Pacific, so you could see the manner in which the entire continental United States was swallowed up in one small corner of the Pacific. It would take, and it would still leave some uncovered space, about six maps of the United States to cover the Pacific Ocean. So we're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of ocean.
That's really helpful. You frequently give us some perspective on that. Yeah. The mass, land mass, and in this case, the mass of the sea.
The distances are prodigious. I mean, when one talks about, for instance, well, let's pop out to Easter Island from South America, you're talking about thousands of miles off the coast of South America, etc. Was one of the reasons, this is just an aside, that fighting the war in the Pacific over this vast ocean was a kind of logistical triumph at which the United States in full war production could do that. And the Japanese were unable to. They simply were unable. They didn't have the industrial capacity to put out the ships, the men, the fuel, everything necessary to fight over that vast ocean. Now, we have divided, we being the Westerns, have divided the Pacific into three cultural groups, which are also to some extent geographical groups. Polynesia, poly, many islands. Micronesia, micro, small islands. Melanesia, black islands. Mela, as in melanoma and other words of with the same root. And we're really talking here mainly about the Polynesian group. Now, the Polynesian group extends all the way, we'll talk more about this later, from Hawaii, going to the southeast, to Easter Island, then all the way across the Pacific to New Zealand, to the Maori people. And when Captain Cook made his several voyages around the world, he was the first really to note that those three island groups that we've talked about, Easter Island, the Hawaiian Islands, and New Zealand, the Maori people, basically belong to the same cultural group, because the language shared many words, many traits, and his translators who came from the Society Islands, which is to say Tahiti, could understand much of what was being said in these various places. And when Cook visited on his second voyage Easter Island and in his third voyage on Hawaii, he understood very clearly that somehow folks had sailed all over this vast ocean. And no one doubted that they got there by boat, however, all the way to get there, of course, but because they didn't drift and they didn't migrate on land, they got there by boat of some kind. And Cook, being a master sailor, also understood that the canoes which he saw, both single-hulled, but mainly the big double-hulled, the catamarans that he saw on his voyage, were magnificent vessels quite capable of ocean-going trips. So he appreciated the culture, both linguistically, but also in terms of the material culture, these magnificent ships that the Polynesians sailed. Now, but he was bedeviled to some extent by the fact that the trade winds blow from the west. I'm sorry. They blow from the east to the west. So you don't easily sail from Easter Island, or for that matter, Hawaii, to New Zealand. You're sailing against the wind almost the entire way. Now, he also noticed, however, that there were seasons, particularly November, December, in which the winds reversed themselves, and that even though there are prevailing winds, those prevailing winds don't always prevail. So it allowed a little bit of window in which you could sail in any direction. And furthermore, although these Polynesian double canoes, these huge canoes, were not terribly weatherly, that means they couldn't sail very close to the wind. If the wind is coming from the east, they couldn't sail within 45 degrees of that. So they couldn't tack the way, let's say, a modern yacht can tack. Nevertheless, they could sail upwind. It just took them a heck of a long time because they were making big tacks to one side, then big tacks to the other, and back and forth, and they go slowly. But, you know, there was a lot of time. So it was possible that these craft could sail all over the Pacific. Now, he died. He was killed in what was then called the Sandwich Islands. We call them the Hawaiian Islands today. And he didn't, of course, was not alive to further develop these ideas or study them. Others speculated about this, but really most people who were interested in the Pacific and sailing, what they were interested in was not how the folks got from island to island, but they were interested in other things, either strategic questions. You know, we want this island because it's important to our empire to have an island there, or treasure, pearls and things like that, or products like copra from coconuts and things like that. They weren't interested in the sort of anthropological question. But in the 20th century, the question came back, particularly in the middle of the 20th century, with a vengeance. And the man who really brought it back on the radar screen was Thor Heyerdahl. And those of us old enough will remember that in 1947, you may not remember the year, but in 1947, Heyerdahl and his friends constructed a balsa log raft in Peru and sailed and drifted this craft out in the direction of Tahiti. They finally crashed on a reef to the north of Tahiti, well to the north, but nevertheless, they got there and they all lived. We're going to talk about Heyerdahl next time because this is a fascinating story. He's a fascinating guy. But suffice it to say at this point that his big idea was that these Pacific islands were populated from South America, which would be in the direction of the prevailing winds, populated by South American native peoples. We'll get to that story. Most people who were interested at this time in this question thought that that was bloody nonsense. And the person who first published an important book on the topic was a New Zealander. He was a civil servant, wasn't a professional anthropologist or anything, civil servant by the name of Andrew Sharp. He published a book called Ancient Voyagers in the Pacific. And his view was that these Polynesians who had gone all over the map, so to speak, were accidental voyages. That in storms, driven off by war, famine, whatever, they had been out there in these boats of theirs, in these catamarans, and sooner or later they were blown or fled to another island group, and from there the same thing happened again, so that they hopscotched across these vast distances. But it wasn't intentional. They weren't trading. They were just sort of poor devils who were caught out to sea and got a little bit like Robinson Crusoe and got blown to the next island, and there they set up some kind of camp and eventually thrived and eventually got blown to the next one. Another New Zealander, and New Zealanders were particularly interested in this because their own native people, the Maori, were just so darn far away from people like the Hawaiian Islanders. I mean, these are thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away. And New Zealanders were asking, how did they get here? And the Maori themselves had myths about this, but they weren't satisfying to the Western mind, so to speak. Anyway, this New Zealander was a physician, an avid and accomplished sailor. His name was David Lewis, and he published a book called We the Navigators. And what Lewis did was he stripped his yacht, which was like a 40-footer, something like that, a robust sailing vessel, stripped it of all modern navigational aids, charts, compass, sextant, radio, everything. And he set out sailing by what he called star charts alone to make long voyages in the South Pacific. So he would memorize what the heavens looked like and the direction and the names and things of stars, and then he would steer his vessel largely by star to his definition. Now, he had made up this. I mean, it was his hypothesis that this is how it was done traditionally, but he had made up his own star charts, which are mental constructs. I mean, they're not written down or anything. And he was extremely successful in this. So in the 1970s, a group in Hawaii picked this up. Again, a lot of interest in Hawaii. How did our folks get here? Where did they go from here, etc.? Who got here first? Were we here before the people in Tahiti got to Tahiti, etc., etc.? And led by a California surfer turned anthropologist by the name of Ben Finney, in Oahu, they constructed something that they called a performance-accurate replica of a big Polynesian catamaran, a voyaging canoe. Performance accurate replica means they didn't use the construction materials that would have been used for additional canoe. They used fiberglass to make the hull, and they ended up with modern sailcloth for the sail and things like that. But the performance characteristics of it were very similar to what was known about Polynesian canoes. And they named this canoe Hokulea, H-O-K-U-L-E apostrophe A, which means star of joy. And the idea was that they would take this canoe on voyages, and they would prove that this canoe could go wherever they wanted it to go. In the Pacific, there was a catch to that. They had a big problem. I'll get to it in a minute. But just a few facts about the canoe. She was double-hulled, the catamaran, as I said. She had two masts, and each carried a single sail in the form of an inverted triangle. In other words, they were, from our point of view, upside down. The broad part was at the top, and that is the shape of the traditional Polynesian sail. She weighed about 12 tons, and she was steered by a single huge oar. Rudders, as we understand them, were unknown. So they had a steering oar. And the steering oar, I saw one of these from an actually Fijian canoe in, where did we see? Well, we saw it in the museum in Fiji. And this oar was very heavy, carved out of a single log. It was 19 feet long, and it took four people on it. Wow. to steer her. This Hokulea that they made could do up to about 6 knots, so she wasn't terribly fast, could sail to within about 75 degrees of the wind. She made quite a bit of leeway because she was shallow draft. She didn't have any deep keel. She would drift when she was trying to sail upwind about 10% to the one side or the other. So she was not anywhere near as good as a modern yacht as far as sailing upwind and things like that. But it didn't make any difference. This is their hypothesis. As long as you knew the sailing characteristics, because you could compensate for all of this. The important thing was to know what the canoe was doing with respect to the water.
And how they could, as you say, compensate or react.
And compensate,
and
right.
Change course, so to
right.
speak.
And they also, the Hawaiian group also said, you know, it makes sense to explore upwind. Upwind means from the west to the east in these latitudes, because if you're trading, it makes it easier to get home. You want to, it's sort of like climbing, you know, a big hill. You're thankful at the end of the climb that you're going to be going downhill, if it's not too steep, rather than going uphill. Anyway, but there was a huge unsolved issue. How do you navigate this thing in a traditional way? And the plain fact of the matter is, nobody knew how to do it. They knew a couple of things. That all heavenly bodies rise in the east because of the rotation of the earth. So, if you're going to navigate by a star, as David Lewis did, what you want to do is you want to pick a star that's near the horizon. Because when you're setting a course on a star, you don't want to have to look up at the star. You want to look directly out at the star. Because if you're looking up at it, there's going to be all sorts of error. You can't steer on something that's almost over your head. So, stars rise in the east and set in the west, and they're most useful when the horizon. Other thing which they understood very clearly was that if you pick a star which is in the direction of your destination, whatever that is, and you know that you're going to drift, you can then pick a star, let's say you know you're going to drift 10%, which on the horizon is 10% off of where you want to go, and steer on that one, etc. The other thing which they understood clearly is that the season of the year and the latitude at which you're sailing determine which stars are coming up, because the heavens don't look the same
right.
in different seasons and different latitudes. So the fundamental skill of navigating by stars is to memorize vast, vast amounts of celestial information, be able to identify individual stars and heavenly bodies, and to know which ones to sail by for how long under what conditions.
I'm curious, is there any indication that there were any written maps, constellation maps at all?
No, there's none whatsoever.
So no one recorded
it? No, none of it was recorded. What they did have, and you can still buy as tourist items, is you can buy little shell maps, and what the shell maps are they're just flat pieces of wood or some kind of woven mat, and they have shells attached to them in the position of various islands in an island group. And then you can draw a line from your island to the next island and get, but those aren't any. They're only useful for inter-island navigation, and basically it's thought that these were used as teaching aids so that young men, because all the navigators were men, boys could look at one of these on the beach and say that Ukulau Island is, you know, this one, and here we're on Umakawa. You know, you go from here to there. But those aren't, they're basically teaching aids.
Right.
Yeah, they're not navigational tools. Now,
so let me just ask another question.
Sure.
So because at one time this knowledge was known not just to one or two people, but it permeated the culture.
Oh yeah, there were.
And so that's came from the oral tradition. Then they told, they
absolutely.
Just showed, they talked and showed,
and the apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So a master navigator would have a bunch of apprentices, and they in turn would to the
and
apprentices.
They just had to know it.
That's right.
It's just known.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other thing that's been understood for a long time, and the Hawaiian people understood it perfectly well, is that ocean swells maintain their direction, particularly out in the Pacific, where they're unimpeded, for long distances. So you can actually steer by swells in a certain orientation to the swell, but you have to know how to read the difference between the deep swell and the wind waves that are on top of it, because they may be completely counter to each other.
And changing all the time.
Yeah. So you have the stars, you have the ocean swells, and you have, of course, the question of currents, which are also, you know, can be understood, but not with tremendous, tremendous precision. And of course, there are many days when, not many days, but there are certainly days when no heavenly bodies are visible at all at night. And then you're left with the swells, a kind of intuitive dead reckoning, and the and your sense of drift. Let's just take one more minute to address one other problem that was also understood. See, what's happened is that by the mid 20th century, actually by the last quarter of the 20th century, all the problems were understood and all the techniques were understood. What was missing is someone who could put them into practice. And so the Hawaiian group was faced with the problem of finding someone somewhere who could actually do this stuff, because none of them could do it. But I just want to say one more word about the other big problem. The first big problem is obviously heading in the right direction. The second big problem is making landfall. And fortunately, almost all the islands in the Pacific are in island groups. So if you were going, let's say, from Hawaii to Tahiti, it wasn't necessary to hit Tahiti on the button, as long as you hit the island group, and from that point on you could find your way. Well, how do you know in this vast ocean when you're near land or approaching land? Clouds cluster above land. We've all seen pictures of these, you know, in the far distance is a cloud, well, there's an island under the cloud. The swells change their direction and their characteristics when they get near land. Objects drift from land, like coconuts. Birds are very interesting because different birds will radiate and fly out different distances. They have a range from land. For example, in the Tuamotu Archipelago, the brown booby can be found as much as 40 miles from land, long before land is visible. But if you see a brown booby, you know, and you can see where it's flying from, you know land lies in that direction and is probably about 40 miles, give or take, away. A black tern in the Tuamotus can only get out about 12 miles before it has to turn back. So if you find a black tern, even if the weather's very bad, you know you're probably within about 12 miles of land, etc. So now we got Hokulea. She's in the water in Hawaii, and they're ready to sail her, but they don't have anyone with the old skills. And so they begin a search of the Pacific to see if they can find a navigator who has the old skills. And it's very interesting because they can't find one in all of Polynesia. They look every place. And people say, oh, yes, my granddad did that. And they say, well, do you know how to do it? Sorry, man, don't have the slightest idea. Just know what granddad talked about. And finally, in the North Pacific, in a small island in Micronesia named Satawal, in the Caroline Island group, they find a navigator, an older gentleman, and his name is Mau Pialuk, known as Mau, M-A-U, Mau. And he agrees to come to Hawaii and navigate this craft. They want to take the craft from Hawaii to Tahiti. That's what their initial voyage is going to be, but they don't know how to do it. So they bring Mau there, and Mau studies the Hawaiian celestial map, if you will, because it's very different from the map that he had in Satawal in the Caroline Islands. And he studies for months, and he takes the craft out and finds its characteristics, etc. And finally, on May 1st, 1976, the Hokulea sets sail from Maui, destination Tahiti, with Mau navigating. Now, Mau has taken under his wing a young Hawaiian by the name of Nainoa Thompson. And so Mau has his first apprentice, and this apprentice becomes very important in the story. Now, as the crow flies from Hawaii to Tahiti, it's about 2,300 miles. And interestingly enough, although we don't think of it this way, Tahiti is to the east of Hawaii. So you don't sail south from Hawaii to Tahiti. You sail south by south, east. You know, you think of Tahiti as being farther to the west than Hawaii. It's not.
Right,
it's
right.
Actually farther to the east. Anyway, leaves for Tahiti on May 1st, as I said, 1976, and 31 days later, they arrive right on target. And he's taken them there only using his star charts, his intuitive knowledge, the currents, the swells, all these traditional things. He knows how to do it, and it's like you know, there's been this torrential rain, and you want to start a fire, and you don't have any matches, and you find, you know, under a bit of moss, one little hot spot that's still burning, and you fan it, and lo and behold, you have fire. I think it's possible to say that if they hadn't found Mom up there in Micronesia, it would have been lost forever, the detailed knowledge. And Mao has, in the person of Nanoa Thompson, a brilliant apprentice. And young Mr. Thompson has, in addition to the Hawaiian sky, he has the planetarium at the University of Hawaii. So he can speed the thing up. You know, he can say, I want to know what it's going to look like in September. And they press a few buttons and things
there
like that.
Is.
And he gets the November, you know, sky at a certain latitude and things like that. So, Nanoa studies. He studies for 4 years to learn the new knowledge. And 4 years later, so which is to say in 1980, Nanoa sets out as the navigator on Hokulea to make the same voyage that Mao had made 4 years earlier. And 33 days later, this young master navigator brings the canoe safely into Tahiti.
About the same time frame as the older master navigator.
Yeah, 2 days
almost
longer.
Two days longer.
And it's interesting because they were shadowed on this voyage by by some kind of yacht, large ocean-going yacht. And it was taking absolute, you know, accurate readings. And you can see, I'm sure you could find it on the internet, you can see a picture of the actual, so they know the actual track of the Hokulea, and then they have the track that Nanoa had set out, which was to sail for a certain distance, you know, in this direction, then make a correction a certain distance in this direction. So it was a series of these, it was a broken line that went along. And the actual voyage is strikingly close to that broken line. Of course, you wouldn't expect it to be, the ship never sails perfectly in a straight line.
Right, the canoe.
But it's striking how close, using only this kind of navigation, he was to that.
And did he have that mapped out before they left?
Oh, yes. He said that to get there, I'm going to do this. Then when I'm at a certain point, all estimated, of course, and all in his head, I'm going to pick other stars. And well, he's changing stars all the time, because in a typical evening sailing by the stars, those stars rise fast enough. So you may have to have, over the course of the night, 6, 7, or 8 different stars
every
that you're
night.
Using. Yeah,
yeah,
every night.
Yeah.
Because as I said, the higher they get above the horizon, the more inaccurate they are.
Right.
So they're changing stars all the time.
33 days and let's say 8 stars a night. That's a
oh,
lot
yeah.
of
oh, yeah.
knowledge.
And the next day it could be the same stars.
Yeah.
It depends how far you've gone.
Yeah.
But sooner or later you have to change stars, because you're going to the south, and so the latitude, the celestial map.
Yeah, will change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's
you would
really
hope it would, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Now, so in 1985, and Nanoa is now a master navigator himself, and he is training young Hawaiians to do this kind of navigating. In fact, not just young Hawaiians, young Polynesians from all over the Pacific are coming to the Hawaiian Islands to study with Master Navigator Thompson. And you can imagine that for certain kinds of kids, young men, to have this opportunity to become a master navigator and study under a master navigator is just, you know, an undreamed of opportunity. Now, so in 1985, Nanoa sets out with Hokulea for a 2-year, 12,000-mile voyage to New Zealand. So this is then the ultimate test of the hypothesis that you can do this, that this is possible. And they trigger, it's already been triggered, a kind of massive, I want my own canoe. So all over the Pacific, on various island groups, little societies building societies are springing up. They're sending young people to be trained in Hawaii to have, and they're building their own voyaging canoes, etc. When we visited Easter Island, it was sort of pathetic because the trees were long ago cut down on Easter Island. I mean, a tree in sight on the whole island. But sure enough, they were trying to build a voyaging canoe because the Easter Islanders wanted one. Too. It is the most inhospitable place. There's no natural harbor. There's no beaches. There's no wood. There's no nothing. And they were trying to build. And I think they may have succeeded in building it. I'm not quite sure. Whether they ever succeeded in sailing it, I don't have the slightest idea.
What were one or two of the resources? What did they build it out of?
Well, they had to bring everything in.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No, they had to bring everything in.
Whatever scrap or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
And in fact, this is parenthetically, but the Hawaiians built another canoe, and of course the Hawaiian Islands didn't have timber that could be cut down. I mean, they had timber, but it was protected timber that would build in a traditional way, rather than out of fiberglass, a voyaging canoe. And I believe I'm correct, but I could be wrong. I think they went to the Haida here in the Northwest, but they certainly went to some Northwestern indigenous group, and they got from them as a gift huge red cedar logs, I guess old growth red cedar, to build a canoe as a gift from one native people to the other. So now the building is largely in traditional materials. Now, so in 87, after 2 years on the road, so to speak, the Hokulea returns back to Hawaii after this 12,000-mile trip, getting them all the way to New Zealand. The canoe's welcomed back by Myron Thompson, who happens to be the father of Nanoa, the navigator. He's the president of something called the Polynesian Voyaging Society. The Polynesian Voyaging Society was the entity put together to raise the money, the publicity, and everything, and to organize for these voyages. And Nanoa Thompson, father, was the president of that. And here's what Myron Thompson said when, in this triumphal return, the Hokulea sails into, I think, it came back to Oahu. I don't think it, to Honolulu. I don't think it came back to Maui. Anyway, here's what he said. What began as a dream, a mana'awa, in the mind's eye of a few, has culminated today. We have all come together with a greater understanding of the world and our place in the world. And I say we, because we were all on that canoe. Whether you strung one lei or a thousand, whether you looked after her, as so many have throughout the Pacific, or had one thought of aloha for her. We voyage together, and we are changed. Hokulea was built to answer questions about her past. We went out as Hawaiians and scientists and came home as Polynesian brothers and sisters. So you can see in all of this, there's a tremendous element of cultural revival and pride and stuff, and in a very healthy way. It doesn't involve killing whales, you know, and other things. All built around the voyaging canoe and the idea of the migration. And so what you asked happened to Ben Finney, who began all this, the California... The
propagation by seed.
Yeah, the California surfer.
Yeah.
Well, Ben Finney had one large strike against him. He was not a Hawaiian. He had not one drop of native blood in him. You know, and you can be a Hawaiian in the sense of a native, but the same way you can be a tribal person. Here, you just have to have a few drops, and that's enough. You can be blonde and blue-eyed, but if you can find those few drops, you are Hawaiian. Ben Finney didn't have a drop. And in a power play, he was excluded from the first and all subsequent voyages of the Hokulea. So we have a case of identity politics, which is the nasty side of identity politics, which is the downside, the negative aspect of this really very lovely cultural revival and this string of good fortune, really, luck, some of it just dumb luck, which led them first to find Mao, then for Mao to find or be found by Nanoa Thompson, who proved to be the absolute perfect first apprentice and then mentor, and then the spread really like wildfire of this idea of the voyaging canoe and migration now by traditional methods of navigation all over the vast Pacific. So it's really quite a nice story.
That's a lovely story. What did literally happen to Ben Finney? Is he still...
I believe, you know, he was a relatively young man in the early 70s when this began. I believe he has an appointment at the University of Hawaii. My guess is that he's probably still on the faculty there teaching anthropology. And he wrote a couple of really interesting books. If one wants to follow up on this story and some of the, you know, much of the detail, which obviously I've left out, I would say go to Amazon, look up Ben Finney. It's F-I-N-N-E-Y. I can't pull the title of his two books about this off the top of my head, but easy to find on Amazon. Very well written and an extraordinarily interesting story in all its detail.
Well, the whole thing is a wonderful story with a really inspiring, I don't even want to say conclusion because the story goes on, but a revival, as you say, of traditional culture and identity. It's interesting that
adventure. I mean, tremendous element of adventure in this too.
Oh, absolutely. And just the whole concept of memorizing the night sky and all seasons, I think, is a great inspiration for me of the human capacity that we really don't tap.
Yeah, and of course, one assumes, anthropologists have assumed, that these kinds of memorizations and visualizations in other cultures that didn't depend the way we do on written materials or printed material was much more highly developed skill, because we don't have to do it. Because we can now just, you know, punch a few buttons on the computer and it'll all come up on the screen.
We just have to understand what we're looking at.
Yeah.
We don't have to go to the roots and create the map in our own being.
No, and retain them.
Exactly. And retain the relationships they have to each other. Well, thanks once again, Richard, for a wonderful morning with this strange and wonderful world. And this is KLOYLP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And look forward to being back with you again the third Monday of July, which I know the next one we're going to be on is the 6th. So what is
that? That's the 20th.
The 20th
we'll be
of
back
July.
The 20th.
With another fascinating story of this strange and wonderful world. And good morning.